Our next speaker is the eminent historian Joyce Appleby, who is professor of history at UCLA and past president of both the Organization of American Historians and the American Historical Association. Her research has covered the history of England, France, and America in the early modern period, and with an abiding interest in the questions about classical liberal values or liberal values and institutions. After graduating from Stanford University in 1950, Professor Appleby first worked for Mademoiselle magazine in New York City. She returned to California afterward to be married, to raise a family, and to continue her magazine and newspaper writing. Later, she enrolled at Claremont Graduate School and received her PhD in history in 1966. She has since been a fellow commoner at Churchill College, chair of the Council of the Institute of Early American History and Culture at Williamsburg. She's a member of the editorial board for the American Historical Review and the William and Mary Quarterly. She's been the Harmsworth Professor of American History at Oxford University and a fellow at Queen's College. In addition to the book I mentioned by her, her most recent book called Inheriting the Revolution, The First Generation of Americans, she's the author of many books, including Ideology and Economic Thought in 17th Century England, Capitalism and a New Social Order, Liberalism and Republicanism in the Historical Imagination, Telling the Truth About History, Recollections on the Early Republic, The Intellectual Origins of Jeffersonian Democracy, An American Journey, and many others. So it's a real pleasure to present Joyce Appleby.
It's a real pleasure to be here and to be able to talk about my new book, Inheriting the Revolution. I chose to study the lives of American men and women born after 1776 because they offered wonderful material for looking at how a revolutionary tradition was dealt with. I wasn't interested in state building, but I was interested in nation building. I was interested in how a generation shapes a society and particularly how they elaborated a new culture. And so I embarked on a study of all the men and women who had been born between the years of 1776 and 1800. And my research was very much like a vacuum cleaner. I just picked up anything that I could find about these lives and about this period. And I used the very most advanced techniques of research. I wrote down everything I found on 4x6 cards, and I filed them alphabetically in empty shoeboxes. Now, the witnesses in my book are those who did something in public. They might have settled a town, they might have invented a product, they might have formed an association, they might be newspaper publishers or writers, even if only the writer of an autobiography, they came into my shoebox. In fact, there are about over 350 men and women who were born between 1776 and 1800 who did write autobiographies, and those of you who've looked at the book will know that I got a lot of personal details from those autobiographies, but they by no means exhaust the people that I looked at. I must have looked at several thousand men and women who fit into this generation. I was, as I said, I was interested in the people who were doing something because I wanted to see this connection between inheriting a set of revolutionary ideas and then actually leading one's life when you had no connection with that revolution and indeed were not in any way familiar with the colonial mores that had shaped your parents and your grandparents. So that this was kind of a decisive break. Now, I recognize that not everyone born after the revolution took part in reconfiguring their society, and I want to make that clear at the outset. Many people didn't have even the minimal resources to make changes in their lives. Other people wanted, most of all, to replicate the way of life of their mothers and fathers. And there were yet other people whose lives were pretty much dominated by that figure, the head of the household, the father, whom the law and custom gave tremendous power over dependents. So I am looking at a subset from within the larger society, those people who did have the opportunity to do something and whose choices, we could say, were a part of shaping that revolutionary tradition into a living cultural tradition. There were four unexpected and interacting developments that shaped the lives of my generation as they were coming of age. One of them was the radicalizing of politics. Another was the revitalization of religion in America. A third was the expanding scope of opportunity, particularly for the young. And finally, there was the abolition of slavery in the North. Revolutions have very unanticipated consequences, and the abolition of slavery in the North was one of them. It was no part of the program of fighting the revolution. It was no part of the resistance movement that Hans has been talked about. And yet, immediately, there was this contradiction between talking about liberty and living with this institution of slavery. And so you had, one by one, the northern states, in the 30 years after independence, finding ways to abolish slavery. Now, this had an enormous impact on the African American population because it suggested that slavery could be brought to an end. And this had a striking effect upon the thinking of this generation. You know, Americans do not get credit for the fact that their legislatures were the first to abolish slavery. The reason they don't is because it was state legislatures. It wasn't the nation as a whole, but slavery was an institution. The laws of keeping human beings in chattel were state laws. It was not a federal law. And so you had northern states being the first in the world to abolish this ancient institution. The revolution had an impact on women as well. Even though they were largely excluded from citizenship, there was this expanding scope of action for ordinary people and this vibrant civil society, the public realm that Hans was talking about, and women found a way to participate. And as they did, the sense of what their appropriate role in society was changed. So while we don't see any really revolutionary action in this generation about what we now call the status of women, it's certainly what they were able to do, and I will mention some of these things later on, had an impact on the next generation, the generation that saw the women's rights movement, the first movements in those directions. What I do in my book is I take particular lives and I use them to tell my story. So I'm going to just pick a few of these lives, but I'm not going to tell you a great deal about them, but to make the points of these interacting and cumulative developments that shape this generation's experience. One of them had nothing to do with the revolution. It was the introduction of manufacturing in Great Britain and the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. Now, this was something that lay outside the United States, but the fact that America was now an independent nation had everything to do with the way in which the American economy picks up on these new developments in manufacturing. And what I found was two things. One, old colonial wealth did not go into new manufacturing ventures. They were too risky. It wasn't anything that appealed to people who had wealth. With very few exceptions, those who developed these manufacturing possibilities, and they were in areas of machine making and in particular anything having to do with the textile industry, because that's where the Industrial Revolution is centered, they came from the ideas of ordinary young men who had gift for mechanics. Eli Whitney is the obvious one that we can think of, but there were dozens of them. The one that I feature is Ichabod Washburn, who was orphaned when he was 7 and is apprenticed and spends his life, his early life, working extra hours so that he can buy off his apprentice and becomes a wire manufacturer in Worcester, Massachusetts. The manufacturing in the North depended upon water power. That was the first power that came from manufacturing. And all through the North, there were all these little creeks and streams that were just perfect for sluicing and turning into water power. And what you have is the people who are taking the risks are the people who have very little to lose. They're the people who have an idea and they manage to borrow, they manage somehow to find the money to put together these new ventures. And what we have is a beautiful example of sweat equity in these ventures. But enterprise was not just related to the economic realm. Another fascinating scope of action for this first generation came about through the revitalization of religion. In America, from the 1790s on into the 1820s, there was a succession of religious revivals, and they one after another, they would affect communities. Just they're sometimes described in terms of fires that are sweeping through a community. What's interesting in the North about these religious revivals is that they connected with this entrepreneurial spirit. And so you had from the very beginning the ideas of young people, and particularly there were young people, being quite grandiose about what you could do with a religion. For instance, there were a group of young men who were attending Williams College who begin to talk to another and decide that it's going to be the work of their generation to bring Christianity to the entire globe. I mean, here they are in this little country, this small, on the edge of the European world, and they have this grand plan. And they managed to convince their elders that this is what American religious energy should go into, and they thought they're behind the forming of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missionaries. And within 10 years, they have got an organization going, and they have tapped into the money and are sending missionaries to Calcutta, to Syria, to Hawaii, to a number of Indian tribes in the West. One of the interesting parts of this is that, and I learned this reading about Ichabod Washburn, my wire manufacturing maven, that the first thing he did with the money that he had earned making waffle irons after hours was to buy the memoir of Harriet Newell. Well, I was in a library. It's wonderful when you're in a research library and you read something like that and you think, wow, they might have the memoir of Harriet Newell here, and I could read this book that he had bought, and I was able to find it. And she was one of the first missionaries. She was a missionary wife who went to Calcutta. She becomes a heroine, and because her memoir becomes a bestseller. But behind this sending out of the Newells and the Judsons, the first four young people set sail from Salem in 1811. They're all under the age of 25, and they are going to go to Calcutta and Christianize all of India. It's quite, you know, a breathtaking ambition. But Newell also decides that he's going to tour the west of the United States and find out the state of godliness or ungodliness in the West. And so he sets out with a Dutch Reform minister and travels all the way to Louisiana, and he is kind of horrified what he discovers, because he says, there are American families in this part of our country who never saw a Bible nor heard of Jesus Christ. Is a fact that ought not to be forgotten, that so lately as March 1815, a Bible in any language could not be found for sale or to be given away in New Orleans. The whole country, from Lake Erie to the Gulf of Mexico, is as the valley of the shadow of death. But typical of this American spirit, he's got to immediately figure out how many Bibles are necessary to bring everyone a Bible. And he sits down there and he pens the whole thing out, and then he decides that there are going to be 500,000 Bibles going to be necessary, and his church, the Presbyterians, aren't going to be able to do it alone. And so he is behind this ecumenical movement of gathering all these Protestant sects into the American Bible Society. I do think that I should add that while it's going to take 500,000 Bibles for the entire world, he estimates that 60,000 will be necessary to fill the gap in New York City alone. So, some things don't change. Now, not all New Englanders were filled with this evangelical zeal, but almost, well, I shouldn't say almost all of them, but a very high proportion of them, particularly among young men, travel outside their home and want to find out what's going on in the United States. And of course, they become the source of information. What economists are always talking about, information costs, well, they're reducing information costs because they are themselves communicants between the different parts of the country. And they begin the tradition of being peddlers, New England and Northern peddlers who go into the South, because the South lacks the manufacturing, all these little manufacturing firms. And then they collect scrap copper, which they bring back, which brings the foundation of the brass button industry in Rhode Island. Well, I'm going to forbear telling you all these fascinating things, but it is, well, one of the things that I found interesting was that by going into the South, the Northerners were exposed, obviously, to a very different culture, but also to different reading tastes. And in these days, there were no Motel 6s and days rests or hotels of any sort, and travelers did put up with people who put them up. I mean, that was just the way. You knocked on the door, and someone found a place for you. But the young New England lads who went south, when they went to a plantation, they never knew where they were going to be put up. Were they going to be put in the slaves' quarters, or were they going to be put in the great house? This was, of course, a matter of some interest to them. But one of them, Bronson Alcott, you may know of as the father of Louisa May Alcott, but he was himself a famous educator in his day. For him, going into the South was quite intellectually liberating because he had access to libraries where he could read John Locke, whom he'd never read before. The fair in New England was pretty heavily theological and composed of sermons. So there was this cross-fertilization that came about with this moving about. And, of course, the rambles of these young people just astounded their elders, because it was something that had just been unheard of before. So that one of the things that you see is this independence, as self-government that Hans was talking about, so does independence go from having a political meaning to having a personal meaning. Young men, and even some women, take this independence as a cue that they can leave home. And I found in many autobiographies where young men make a bargain with their fathers. They recognize their father's right to their labor until they're 21 or 22, but they make a bargain that they will send back some money if they can go out and go into school teaching or peddling when they're 16, 17, and 18. The travels weren't all from north to south. There was travels from south to north. And among the important migration from south to north was that of free blacks, because the abolition in the north was accompanied by an increase in the ease of manumitting slaves in the south. Manumission was a master freeing a particular slave through a legal document, whereas abolition is getting rid of the laws themselves. And we had in this period the fastest growing part of the population was that of free blacks. There were many factors in there. Many blacks fought in the revolution. Every state mobilized slaves, Africans, in the revolution except for South Carolina, and it was generally understood that they would get their freedom if they fought in the revolution. And there were a number of other facts. It was easier to liberate oneself if there was a north where there wasn't slavery that you could go to. One of the most interesting southerners born in North Carolina to go north was a man by the name of David Walker. And David Walker was a new person and personality in the American scene. He was an angry African-American who was well-read and saw the offense that slavery was, and was able to write about it. He wrote a book called Walker's Appeal. And in it, he begins by saying that he had been troubling the pages of history to find out what our fathers have done to the white Christians of America to merit the punishment that we are enduring. Now, this is one of the things that was most interesting about this generation, and that was the importance of print material. Of course, there have been printing presses in America before, but because of the mechanization that I talked about earlier, and the fact that the United States government itself wanted to promote newspapers and publishing and post offices because they thought they were an integral part of having a free society, you had a proliferation of newspapers, of printing presses that were publishing material. This American Bible Society is soon cranking out 1 million Bibles. It's just astounding, the number of printed materials that are put into circulation. In 1822, even though the United States is about one quarter the size of Germany, France, or England, there are more newspapers published in America than any other country in the world. And the reason I mention this is because a newspaper printing something has an intrusive potentiality. You can talk about an experience, which you can criticize someone's way of life, and put it in print, and put it in all kinds of people's hands. And this is what happened with Walker's Appeal. Black seamen took these copies of it into the South, and this was just outrageous to Southern planters, who are in control of their environment, and yet they're not in control of what other people can do in writing, getting hold of a printing press, and circulating material that talks about slavery in a very critical way. The official Southern response to the publication of David Walker's Appeal was swift. He was personally denounced with a price put on his head, and the legislatures of Georgia, North Carolina, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Virginia passed laws making it a crime to teach slaves to read or write. What I think is fascinating in this period was that that there was much, there's an air of expectation and yet also of anxiety that hung around this question of race. And we have to sort of remove what we know about race relations in America in the 19th century and think about how they might have imagined them. There was an expectancy that things could open up. And the question really was, how were white Northerners going to respond? Were they going to defer to their principles and honor and protect the lives and property and freedoms of African Americans in their midst? Or were they going to be pulled towards white supremacy, towards this association with Europe that the Southerners were always talking about? There's a great deal of tension around this issue. But what I think is extremely important for us to realize is that in this generation and the ones that came after it, there's never a time when slavery wasn't an issue of concern. It never went away. That contradiction was always there. It was a terrible thing to have slavery. There was hypocrisy involved, but it was never a quiet, smug hypocrisy. It was always, I would say, a tormented one. Well, let me just quickly summarize by saying that opportunity that I've talked about was never even-handed. It came to men before women. It came to whites before blacks. It came to readers and writers before manual laborers. It came to the young before the elderly. But it did come in great abundance into this generation, and it had an enormous impact upon it, because there was very much a sense of a variety of things that people could do that they hadn't been able to do before. So this was a generation that I would say, in summarizing, that was confronted with great change. There was a new constitutional government. There was an economy that was bursting out of its geographic and institutional limits. There was a venerable Protestant faith that was moving in new directions. And this made the generation that inherited the revolution quite self-conscious shapers of a liberal society. The patterns of their response to the American Revolution very much set the parameters for American thinking about society, about politics, about religion, about individualism. Working through all of these transformations that I have mentioned, there was also the creation of a new ideal. It was largely an ideal about men, but it was about man, not an American Adam, but an American doer, American homo father, as Locke refers to it. The idea of a man pulling on his own inner resources, acting independently, being himself responsible, and following his own goals. What I think is interesting is that this ideal was also attractive and influential with African Americans as well as women. And because it retains a certain vitality today, it aroused my curiosity about its origins, and I hope will arouse yours as well. Thank you.